Okay, good morning. Today is the day after Thanksgiving vacation, which means that you have only 2 weeks till your final exam. I have two announcements this morning. The first is that I want to have a meeting of the people interested in the spring seminar at a time that I know you're all going to be here, like around 1 o'clock on the day we have the final exam. So after, between the final exam and the wine tasting, we'll have our first meeting to talk about the seminar, because I know you'll probably be here that day. Second thing is that a few days ago I was over on Sproul Plaza and I met these Cal veterans, and there's a small group of veterans on campus, and they're really nice people, but they basically have a really broken and lame website, and they want to hire somebody. They want to have someone help them, and I'm going to pay for them to have somebody help them over the break. So if someone has a few hours they would like to work for the veterans to overhaul their website and update their content, I'll talk to them and we'll make some arrangements to work with them to help them out. Okay. Today is our first lecture on applied IR and natural language processing. This is a topic that I always put at the end of this class because it's a way to bring some of the topics of the more conceptual or theoretical topics of IO and IR together at the end of the semester. We'll talk today about machine translation, about the idea of the web as a large corpus of information used to enhance natural language processing applications. Talk a bit about speech processing and a bit about information extraction. Let me put this in context. This is the first of two lectures this week on natural language processing. And then that's it. Next Monday we have Alumni Day, where we'll have five or six alums come back to talk about their jobs, mostly highlighting the 202-ish aspects of their jobs at my request. People from Twitter, Google, Kaiser, and other places, Genentech, a few other places. There will be an optional assignment that day to write about sort of what you hear that day as a way to, I think we'll either have you toss out your worst of your assignments or something like that if you want to do this extra credit little writing assignment. And finally, the Wednesday after that, a week from Wednesday, will be a course review, and then 2 weeks from today will be the final exam. This will be, as you notice, it is a three-hour exam. That is not really a three-hour exam. It's probably going to be only a marginal bit longer than the midterm, but I want to make sure there's absolutely nobody has any concerns about the time on the exam to get it done. And even so, it will be open book, open note, and so on, as we did at the midterm. But if you still want to do an oral exam instead, then talk to me in the next couple of days and we'll make arrangements for that. But again, it'll be just like the last one, multiple choice, short answer, kind of short essay kind of question, where you pick some number of some. That's what I mean by multiple choice. You pick the ones you want to answer and ignore the ones you don't want to answer. We have posted last year's final exam on the forum pages. Not a lot of people have looked at them based on the number of views of the pages, but I suppose that's what you're going to do today in your section, to look at them together, and I'm really excited about that, so that you'll be able to have a more meaningful interaction with your TAs the week from today, because they're not going to be at your meeting today. So it's an optional section, because no one will be there to know whether you came or not, but I encourage you to go. And then afterwards, we have our annual 202 wine tasting to celebrate the end of the 202 part of the semester. And last year we divided the class into Simononians and Weinbergers. The Simononians got to use the controlled vocabulary for tagging the wines, and the Weinbergers just made it up. And it made for an interesting tag cloud after about the 10th or 11th wine. Okay. So let's talk about this transition from information retrieval to natural language processing. To set the stage, remind you that information retrieval is a situation where a person formulates a query in response to some information need and poses that query against some collection of documents, and the results are some set of documents that supposedly satisfy the query, where query is expressed in some representation that is the same as that of the collection, and the IR model specifies how that comparison is made to how a satisfaction is calculated. That could either be an exact match in the Boolean model, or it can be a more continuous notion of similarity based on some notion of statistical similarity between the representations of the document and the query vectors. But the bottom line is that the IR system doesn't understand what it does, and it doesn't yield any information but things that it doesn't retrieve. So you don't know what's in the collection on the basis of doing a query. So that poses two challenges. The first is that we often want to get past just the retrieved document. We don't want to find the document, we want to answer some questions. So there are things we could do that would enable us to more closely answer the question we posed. Now we could, of course, highlight the terms that we used in the query that might get closer to answering the question, but it would be better if we could somehow actually understand or process the document results in a way to get more precise information. That might be extracting the most informative parts or summarizing the documents that you find, or even actually trying to answer the question by coming back with, this is the answer to your question, by doing processing the query to make it into the form of a question. And that's really one of the goals of NLP, to use a language as inputs or outputs to actually answer questions as opposed to just find results. It's a very broad field. As you can imagine, it involves a lot of different disciplines. And I'm putting this in the course because I think it's a nice way to tie together a lot of the techniques we talked about earlier this semester. And, of course, the usual trade-offs are very manifest. I can make a very long list of NLP applications. I'm going to talk about a bunch of these in the next two lectures. Machine translation, speech processing, summarization we will talk about. We'll probably hint at spelling correction. Some of these, I think the last two, will be illustrated by Julian on Wednesday, when Julian shows some of the cool work done by the I.O. lab this semester to generate synonyms or to assign metadata, essentially to solve Doctorow's problem. There's a whole problem set in that class to do that, how you would basically resolve the Doctorow questions about metadata. On Wednesday, we'll talk a lot more about text categorization and clustering, that is ways to sort the document collection into two or more bins based on a number of different characteristics. Might be things like separating spam from not spam, or things you care about, things you don't care about, or trying to identify the author of a document that's of suspected authorship. One thing we'll end with is the idea of automated customer service, which brings together a number of these things where you have to identify relevant documents, perhaps identify the sentiment or the tone of the question that's being asked by the person who wants customer service, and so on. And perhaps even route the question to the person or source most able to answer them. All right, well, let's begin with an example that I think most of you have seen. If you haven't, have all of you seen the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey? If you haven't, this is an absolute classic movie, done about the time I was in high school in 1968, but it's still very, very current, I think, when you see this movie. And in this movie, there is an onboard computer called HAL, H-A-L, which of course was named because it was one letter shifted from IBM, which was the dominant computer manufacturer at the time. And the astronauts talk to HAL by talking to it. That's how they communicate with the computer. So this particularly important scene, you see HAL here in the background, and the two astronauts are in the pod, the kind of escape pod that they have, because they want to make sure that HAL can't hear what they're saying. And they're talking about something that they're worried about. After this particular scene, Dave asks HAL to do something. He says, what does he say? That's what he said. He wants HAL to open the pod bay doors. And what does HAL say?
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
All right. Now, this is a really great, great movie because it was so far ahead of its time in terms of proposing the kinds of new kinds of computer capabilities and the interactions between people and machines, interface and so on. Why can't HAL unlock the doors? HAL doesn't want to unlock them. It's not that HAL doesn't understand the question. He understands appropriately the question. He understands even the deep intent of the question, which is the... But how did he know what the deep intent really was? He read their lips. So even though they went inside this little pod, so Hal could not hear them talk, because of course the whole spaceship has got microphones that can talk to Hal anywhere. Hal read their lips through this glass portal window of the space pod. So if you haven't seen this movie, has anyone not seen this movie? Because we should have like a party or something, and we'll have like a, we'll go get the movie, we'll run it, we'll have a 2001 party or something. We'll have 202 interaction, we'll talk about the concepts during the movie. Alright? How'd that sound? 2010 is a much crummier movie. That's just my opinion. So this movie, this is 1968, but it really poses a number of challenges to the natural language processing field. What's interesting is at the time this was posed, it was so far ahead of even anyone's capabilities. It's still pretty far ahead of people's capabilities. Even 2001, we thought all this would be easily done. We're now 8 years past it, and we haven't been able to do what Hal was able to do. Now, this machine translation starts again in the early 1950s with great optimism, partly motivated by, of course, the Cold War. And so there's this supposedly apocryphal example, which was a turning point in natural language translation research, when they were talking about how they were likely to have machine translation of Russian to English anytime soon now. So someone goes into this to the consul and types in, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," and it comes back, "The vodka is strong, but the meat is rotten." And that was a real disappointment to the researcher who thought he was going to be able to show that he could, you know, translate simple sentences. Why doesn't this work? What was the mechanism that the researcher was trying to use to translate Russian into English and vice versa? Yes? He was trying to obviously do something pretty shallow, looking up words in dictionaries and just substituting words, and anything which is at least a bit sort of metaphorical or creative or poetic is going to have real problems with that. Who was funding this work? Military. Is something else to add? You have something to add here?
Oh, this is
a bag of words. It's a bag of word translation, and it doesn't exactly work. Okay. So we started off with this great optimism, which quickly turned to extreme pessimism. In fact, by the mid-60s, a very high-powered advisory commission said to the U.S. government that they should no longer fund this up because it was never going to be possible. There was no predictable prospect of useful translation. And we said, why don't we just instead use computers to build tools to help human translators? Which wouldn't be a bad idea, right? To say that instead of having machines do it, which is impossible, let's make it easy to have people do translations. So let's have tools to support human people. At the same time, they had a little loophole. They said, well, maybe if we support lots of money into university, we could still solve this problem in basic research. And that actually paid off a little bit. Usually my of work, this, of course, now is in the age of Chomsky and sort of natural language, sort of language processing. Huge amount of work went into handcrafted translation systems with special grammars and processors to do things like analyze the syntax and the morphological structure of words, lots of dictionaries, very intensely semantic language-based approaches to translation. And it still didn't get very far. As I mentioned in the lecture earlier when I talked about dimensionality reduction, there was this ongoing dialectic between statistical and language-based attempts to process language. And there was a major turning point in the early 1990s thanks to IBM Corporation, which developed Candide systems for translation, which relied on purely statistical analysis and example-based methods to translate documents by matching phrases within the documents, kind of aligning them into like slots. It used a very large corpus of English and French documents which had extremely reliable bidirectional translations. That's really important to say, here are two documents doing exactly the same thing in two different languages. That's often hard to get a collection like that. Where do you suppose the IBM people got this? Where do you find a extremely reliable, authoritative collection of bilingual documents? Yes, Shang. You find it from a government, like the Canadian Parliament. which is mandated by law to have laws published in English and French that mean exactly the same thing. And so there's actually a lot of work that's gone on in the context of, say, the European Parliament or the Canadian Parliament, where you have this problem. Of course, the problem is much worse in Europe now, where you have like 16 languages or something. And imagine the job of the poor translators there who have to somehow produce authoritative versions of documents in Maltese the morning after a debate takes place, even though there's only one person in the world that's a bilingual Maltese to Slavonian translator or something like that. So if you know a lot of exotic languages in Europe, it's a great time to get a job in the European Parliament, it turns out. Okay, and this really has become the standard approach for getting a lot of translation done, to have a very large corpus of documents in multiple languages, especially where they're in their attempts to be authoritative. And the web has done a lot of that. So there's a lot of people who have translated like technical documents, the work of governments, but also things like open source communities have an awful lot of this sort of thing. There's actually large amounts of collections of bilingual documents. And Google has done a tremendous job harvesting that web collection, especially the bilingual parts of it, to build translation. And many of you probably use Google Translate. I've used it 4 years in a row as an experiment. I come every week to this lecture and I go and I run the same passage through Google Translate and into a number of different languages so I can see how it changes over time. So here you see a paragraph I wrote in 2005. I wrote this paragraph by taking a press release and I made it a little bit more difficult. And I wanted to run it through different languages. So here it is. It says, Microsoft's release of its Xbox 360 video games console begins a new phase in the battle to remove Sony's PlayStation from the top spot. If it succeeds, the software giant may be tempted to make more incursions into the competitive market for home entertainment hardware. Why will this be a challenging paragraph to translate? Okay. Well, there's some dangling phrases around. There's definitely a complicated sentence from a grammatical standpoint. Pratik. There are definitely some, we call them named entities, some proper nouns and names. Thomas.
There are expressions like top spot that probably don't
match. Top spot. Battle giant. I want a little metaphor of the war and industries. I want to make this into kind of a... It could sound like this in English as a regular, ordinary piece of text, but you shove it through a translator and it may have trouble with that, with some of that somewhat more metaphorical language.
There's also home entertainment,
the
hyphenated compound, adjective. A lot of
the industry
don't get that.
All right, well, we'll see. So anyway, so I ran this through German into German. So I did this round trip, and you can ask yourself, is round tripping a fair test of machine translation? We'll come back to that. All right? So I turn it English to German, and then I take the German and I run it back to English. I'm testing simultaneously the English to German and the German to English translation with this test. Okay? So I run it through in 2005 and I get the next paragraph. The upper point we get into the top spot. Provoked in order to form more ideas into the free market for house maintenance small articles. Okay? Well, a year later... it has changed. It's not clear that it's any better, but it has definitely changed, hasn't it? So there's been some tweaking of these, one or both of these algorithms, from either English to German or German to English. I did it again. Now here's the last one I did yesterday. The last one. Microsoft's version of its Xbox 360 video game console starts a new phase in the fight for Sony's PlayStation for first place to remove. If it succeeds, the software giant may be tempted to make further interventions in the competitive market for home entertainment hardware. Notice the subtle change from intervention from incursion, for example. All right? I mean, there's some... The sentence structure has changed. We had from the top in 2007, now it says from first place to remove. It's actually more awkward, I think. But the point is, it's changing. Let's try a more difficult language, I think, something which is less similar in structure to English, namely something like Chinese. Okay? We run through Chinese in 2005. And it's barely grammatical in 2005. Okay? It actually makes a greater improvement to 2007 than the German one did, so there must have been a lot of work in 2006 and 2007 to work on Chinese. Okay? I like the Throne of the World. That's one of my favorite ones. All right, because they clearly didn't like Top Spot. That was literally just probably just a pass through at some point. Like, we don't know what this is, but let's put it back in the same place, possibly, kind of thing. But they wanted to try to work on the Throne of the World, which is probably closer to what the meaning is. Okay. Now look at how it looks like as of yesterday. Well, what are you laughing about? The hardware invasion. Well, I mean, so it hasn't, it's not as good as German. So there's no question that English to Chinese back to English isn't as good as English to German back to German. Okay? And so we ask ourselves, is this good enough? And what are we comparing it to? Now, I want to note that this last year, Google added an interesting feature to the translation page, which says, after you get the translation back, it says, do you want to contribute a better translation? So it's asking people, when they see the translation, to see if they want to actually change it. Why would they want to do that? What would that be doing? What's the motivation behind that feature? You're getting close to being done, Thomas. Okay, go ahead.
It's adding to the collective knowledge. Because if you have more people who are making correct translations and they kind of match up with other users, then Google will sort of know, this is actually a better translation.
Yeah, they're trying to do like that image game or the crowdsourcing game where they're saying, let's find ways, people who actually really know this particular domain, perhaps, maybe someone who's a really good bilingual speaker in the two languages can actually help us. But let me ask the question, is this a fair test? Is round tripping a fair test? And what are we really comparing it to? So think of, what does round tripping test require for it to work? I have language A going to language B, and then B going to language A, and I'm comparing, you know, this against this. That's what I'm testing, right? Now, what could cause that to not be great? A to B could be fantastic, right? But then B to A could be not so good, or vice versa. B to A could be fantastic, but A to B is bad, so, you know, B to A is working with bad input. So, which are these, I mean, so is it a fair test? That's the question. Jessica?
I don't think it's very fair. I can imagine a situation in which A to B would be fantastic, but B to B is eligible, but not necessarily good enough to be normal. Like, the B to A translation engine might not understand as well the syntax of B the first time. And so, you know, going from B to A would cause it to sort of pick up a little bit more, maybe much odd results.
Okay, I think that's not a fair test. I think it's sort of a somewhat unfair test for Google. But on the other hand, what does it tell us? I mean, what? Let me ask a different question. Is every one of these translations equally important to the world or to Google? What a good example of A and B. So A is going to be is A English? Or is B English? Which is more important for English? Is English as A or English as B? Okay, well, the question is, what is the most widely spoken and written language in the world?
English.
Okay. What is the language which is most widely learned as a second or third language? English. Okay. So in some sense, if you can get to some version of English, then more of the world will be able to deal with this. On the other hand, so if you are Estonian and you if you're Estonian, what's the likelihood you're going to be able to find Estonian documents you want to translate to English? Well, you already read Estonian, and you probably are learning English as a second language, okay? Whereas no one else in the world wants to get Estonian documents out. And so there are some clearly some incentives here. Now, the other question is, of those people who are learning English as a second language, how good do they actually have to be, or how good actually are they? So, if I have... Yes?
Isn't this sort of reinforcing the kind of bias that we have?
I'm shocked that there could be bias in anything that's done in terms of web translation. Well, of course there's bias. Why would Google have all of its linguists and engineers working on stuff that doesn't matter to them or to the world? So they're going to do things which make economic sense based on the language distribution of the world. So the rich are going to get English is going to get richer. Simple as that. We can already muddle through the world if we just don't speak any language. We can go around and we can get someone to translate. We can even use Google Translate for us.
It sounded like you were saying, though, that essentially these other translations don't matter at all.
No, they matter some. But where's the economics in it? Let's compare. Let's finish this question. So, I speak terrible every other language. I speak very passable French, and I speak no other language. I speak very, 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 very bad Spanish. Okay, I'm learning it. My real estate and farm worker Spanish, so I can have people come work at my house, kind of thing. All right, that's it. All right, but I don't speak any other language. All right. People who speak English as a second or third or fourth language speak a lot better than I speak their language. Okay, but nonetheless, they don't speak English. So there's probably some kind of like not quite perfect English, which is the world's most spoken language. And so if you compare that as the most spoken language of the world, the most written language of the world, then this is damn good translation. Because even somebody who... is, let's say, from a language that's very different, a Korean, right? Chinese. I mean, think of theirs English and think about how this is probably is pretty good. So I think it's an unfair test, but it really shows how good this technology is. Yes?
Including second language speakers versus English, which is 508 million.
Right, I will put my source up and we can compare. I have a source that says English. I mean, maybe you're right about Mandarin. I mean, although I've been arguing, I mean, people said that Mandarin is lots of different dialects and tonal, it's not really the same language, but I don't know. I'll check this.
Yeah, I just had a question from like round tripping. In the sense, is it required to have word to word kind of like the same word? The top word is as good as like mouth computer. The context is the same.
No, it could be doesn't have to be the same language. I'm saying, well, it has to just mean the same thing. So I wouldn't mind if it says market leader. I think I'm astonished when it says top spot. But the question is, does it mean the same thing when it comes back? And so when it comes back and says, we've changed the hardware invasion, that's a different term somehow than the, invading the home entertainment market. Now the hardware invasion is not the same concept. Whereas, the competitive market for family entertainment, that's the same concept we've got. So German's doing a better job semantically as well as syntactically. Chinese went astray someplace, but I'm not sure whether it went astray in which direction. So again, these, as you can imagine, these are very complicated problems, and they're using a mixture of language and statistical approaches. I mean, they're going to use a lot of early stage language processing to find parts of speech and do some morphological analysis, and then they're going to use statistics for the bulk of it to get the matching of the sort of substitutability of phrases in context. That's where we have huge collections of data about what are the patterns of words in different languages, and we try to line up the corresponding words. And the reason this works is because there's just so many words now in these large text collections, like the web. I mean, as the paper I had you read about the web, it's just a staggering size compared to everything else we've ever used for doing language processing research. Yes?
How do these systems take into account, first of all, false cognates, but then on the flip side, words that are used, we use French words in English, and Japanese words are direct transliterations of English words.
It would have to have, you know, a dictionary that says these are the ones which are the little substitutions. I mean, again, there's just lots and lots of resources that get brought together in a problem like this. Well, a lot of it's contumed. So that's when you say, this person says, I'm going to fix this. And then they say, what are the most commonly fixed phrases? Maybe we'll go make a special hack on that one so that even we have to override the data somehow. So, I mean, when I was in graduate school, we used to use the Couchère-Francis corpus to do language work. And this was had a million words in it. It was amazing. We could say, let me find all the words in English that have four letters with a vowel in the fourth position. And we'd use this for doing, you know, experimental psychology and linguistic kind of research. The British National Corpus, which was talked about extensively in that paper, has 100 million words. But that is trivially small compared to something like the Google corpus or the Microsoft corpus, because, I mean, even in the BNC, with 100 million words, that means a lot of words occur like 50 times, the long tail of the zip distribution. And that's not enough to really do good language statistics. So this wonderful phrase that says, the web is not representative of anything other than itself, but then neither are anything else. So, I mean, every corpus is sort of its own little world, and the web is just so much bigger than any other possible corpus in some sense. I mean, it's probably a few trillion words are in the Google corpus, and that's probably orders of magnitude bigger than anything else except perhaps Microsoft's or maybe Yahoo's, although I'm sure that Google's is the largest. So there's this interesting table there in that paper that compared the number of words in the BNC corpus for different words and phrases. I've extended this several times. Here you see the phrases in the BNC like medical treatment, prostate cancer, deep breath, occurring, you know, hundreds of times. In Google, the first year I taught this class, medical treatment occurred 12.9 million times as a phrase. Interestingly enough, if you look at these things over time, every year it's a different number. So why is, whenever time I update this table, the numbers change for Google? Ian?
Well, they estimate how many they have in their corpus. And so these numbers can change
daily. And they're not right. Right, so, but why are they changing?
They're changing their index size.
They're changing the index size. They're adding stuff. They find new sources. They put them in. So, I mean, these are clearly just estimates. So I wouldn't, you know, make a bet on the number that's going to pop up in that. But certainly you get a sense of the relative proportions of these phrases in the language. What's interesting is that when I ran Yahoo in 2005, it was bigger than Google on every one of the phrases. And I couldn't believe that Yahoo's index was bigger than Google's. But what would that tell us if Yahoo's numbers are bigger than Google's? Surely someone has an opinion about why Google... No, someone who hasn't talked yet. So Tony, you've been talking too much. You're done for the day. Thank you. Okay. Why would Google's corpus be... Why would Google's number be smaller than Yahoo's? Emily. They may just index differently, right? They may have this, you know, maybe they count it. Maybe they don't do the same stemming algorithm. Who knows what? They all have a reason why it could be different. So, again, the size of the collection and the index size and the words you get, it all very dependent on exactly how they go about doing things. What's amazing to me is that I ran a query using all those words, medical treatment plus prostate cancer plus deep breath plus so-and-so, and I have found 5 papers in the last 5 years that you have all of them. It's fine if I lecture notes, people. Come on. I know it's the day of Thanksgiving, but of course it will find my lecture notes every year. So it occurs 5 months. Class by lecture notes. That's why they all occur in one document. Okay.
It goes down
because maybe they decided to change with the index things. Maybe they figured that, you know, after the first 500,000 it was like done. You know, maybe they change the notion of relevance where they have a different cutoff or something when they estimate the number. What I think is interesting is that you can use the web for spelling correction in a way that this might be something that's obvious to you, but to me it wasn't obvious. So I say, how do you spell weird? Well, weird appears 16.7 million times, W-I-E-R-D, not W-I-E-R-D, occurs 1.4 million times, so that's one-tenth as often, so maybe it's the first one is the correct spelling. And Google's hinting by saying, maybe you meant to spell it this way, okay? But you see that, here's a word that's spelled, you know, a million times wrong. I've actually found a wonderful example where it's spelled wrong on the page. In the title of the page, the heading of the page has it spelled correct, and then in the little tab where you put the title of the document in the HTML is spelled wrong. So the title bar and the title of the document have different spellings of the same word. Quite interesting. Anyway, so yes, Joan. That's correct. It could be spelled wrong intentionally by saying, isn't it weird that you could spell this word wrong and spell it wrong? But I think that's probably a pretty small proportion of people intentionally misspelling words. I mean, okay, you're right. The one about cats, they intentionally spell words wrong. Okay, so that's one I would probably try to carve out of my Google index on counting. So there should be a special hack in Google's index and say, and the following websites don't count these words as correctly spelled. Make a note. Yeah, Ian. To that in a minute. Okay. What this suggests is that you can see how you can now start to imagine how a web corpus can be used to improve translation, because we have lots of phrases we want to translate. We can look at a word in one language, like the French phrase groupe de travail, and we can look at the individual words in that it would translate to. We could see that it means group or group, collective or collective, and travail is work or labor, something like that. We look at all the possible phrases you could get in the target language of English and see that by far the most frequent use of those two English words is work group. So maybe that's the right translation. That's going to be the one which is the most English sounding when we get to the other side of this translation. That makes sense what we're doing? So, sure, labor cluster is a possible combination of the words, of the possible translations of group and travail, but they never appear as a phrase. And so, work group looks like a much better choice for a group de travail from French to English. We could do this for all sorts of different things. Another example is this one, which is the prenominal adjective order. When you have multiple adjectives in front of a noun, they actually follow patterns. So we say my big fat Greek wedding. We don't say my fat Greek big wedding. And who knows why, we just do. Okay? And so we could look in for the search for big fat and fat big and find that big fat is many, many times more frequent than that one. I won't do that because in fact you get a lot of porn when you do that phrase. So I don't want to show you it, but it's a bad example, I think, but you get the idea about this. This is an example from Marty Hurst's class, so I'm not gonna blame her on it. I didn't realize until I actually ran the query that was the problem. Then I'm gonna do it now. Okay. A really important part of translation and of other natural language processing is the problem of named entity recognition. And this is where you have these proper names or items that are need to be treated special because they're sort of specific entities rather than generic uses of the words. So these are going to be things like peoples and places and other kinds, maybe named events, so on. And this is basically done by lookup. We have dictionaries and we have patterns that suggest the way in which these things tend to co-occur. And we do this because if we don't do it, we end up with a lot of bad translations. If we have the word Golden Gate Park and we say, oh, there's golden, that means, you know, what's gold in Spanish?
Dorado.
Dorado. And gate in Spanish?
Puente.
Puerta. Puerta and park. So you would translate that literally and you'd get something totally bogus in English if you came back. And so we need to do this for chemical names and species and proteins and all sorts of special things. We want to say that's an important thing to get right, even though the words it used may not in fact be treated as individual nouns. We also run into the problem here of called co-reference resolution, where the same entity is being referred to in different ways. This is a situation where people trying to not make their text boring, and so they'll say the software giant Gates and his army to mean metaphorically to apply to Microsoft, but in fact if you said Microsoft, 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 it would be a lot easier to translate. Pratik.
Well, how about the context? Because in English, bank can mean
that's why we have to grab this as a and pull it out as a special entity and not break it up and translate. That's the point. We're not going to break up and translate the part. We're going to use it as one whole thing. That's the whole point of this. We want to not break it up. If we look at the language, we can find that this is a table I found somewhere that says, well, of course this depends on the structural regularity of the language. And if we look at sentences that contained named entities, two relationships account for 60% of them, namely e-verb e and e-noun phrase preposition e. So these patterns account for a huge amount of the named entities, and eight patterns account for 95% of them. So they occur in sentences in stereotypical ways, and that helps us to find them. So these kind of techniques of phrase matching and entity detection, again, are going to be really important in NLP, and we'll come back to those later today when we talk about information extraction. But for me, I'll take a little detour through speech recognition, which was also implied in the 2001 example. This has a long history with NLP in the same way that translation does. It's in some way the translation problem, but harder because it has the initial signal processing, because instead of having a word in a character set, we have to first figure out what the characters are by processing the speech signal. It started off being heavily rule-based, but now has moved primarily to statistical processing. Here's a kind of goofy slide that shows how it works, but basically you had to take the analog signal, filter it, separate it into little frequency bands, normalize it for amplitude and speech rate. I'm a tough person to recognize, I bet. But that's the easy part.
Do you make any demographic inferences when you're trying to recognize speech?
Absolutely, and you'll see that in a minute. We can classify speech sounds by language, because, and even dialects of languages, because there are only 40 different phonemes in English, but they have lots of different nuances based on the kind of English being spoken. So Julian's English is different from Pratik's English, which is different from mine, which is different from Alex's. So we identify the phonemes, which are the concept, that is the sound, the name of the sound pattern, and then we look at a probability distribution, saying which patterns tend to follow each other, what's the most likely sequence of phonemes and word boundaries. And we have this, we use a lot of statistics of the language to do this. So for example, we know that in English, S, this S sound, is often followed by a T sound or a P sound or that. It's not often followed by a D sound or an R sound. Okay? But in some Indian languages, SR is a very common word, like Shri. Right? Very common. We don't have any SR words in English. Okay? And so we use this transition probability in a hidden Markov model to recognize words. So here you see, we start with the sound puh, the which is a bilabial stop, the unvoiced bilabial stop. And we will say that with some probability, the sound after that is puh versus po. And then if you have a T coming up, then that is good. But now you have puh or pot or pot. And then we say have an A or an A after that. So we have potato or potato or whatever the possibilities are. And we find a way through this graph and end up with a word recognized as potato. Whether it was potato or potato, we get to the end saying it was potato with some probability. This can be remarkably accurate if we have been trained, if we've trained it to a particular speaker's voice, and many of you have probably used things like naturally speaking. I certainly tried it. This is the most popular voice recognition software. You can plug it into your PC, I think. Maybe even on the Mac. I don't know about the Mac. I know it works on the PC. A lot of people use it on the PC. Any of you use this, naturally speaking? You can do your email by talking to your computer, and it will then create your email for you, recognizing the speech. IBM has a version called Via Voice, which is now bundling aggressively in products. It's embedded Via Voice technology. So you can talk to your chair. Things like that. And we often use this. You've all dealt with speech recognition in IVR, that's integrated voice response systems, in customer service, self-service. And this is harder because it has to be speaker independent, because anybody can call them and dial up to United Airlines rather than just the person that has been trained by United Airlines. On the other hand, you have a constrained vocabulary, so that makes it easier. You've all used these, right? Do I need to play an example? No. Okay. But Genesys and Voxio are the typical companies that do this. And so I would just for fun, I want to play it. Where are you, Genesys?
Thank you for calling SkyWorld Airlines Rewards Program. Please send your 5-digit cap number. 15234.
You've all used these, right? Okay.
Say,
so, yeah, the trick is that if you have a constrained dialogue, you don't have to actually recognize that much. You can just distinguish between pretty coarse things. And that's how we make this thing work for anybody dialing up. Now, speech synthesis, which you might think is just the exact opposite of this, is completely different. It's actually a much easier problem, and let me show you something about that.
Being able to synthesize speech from computer reader full text is useful in applications that require spontaneous interaction or where reading is impractical, like when you're driving and need directions. Speech synthesis enables accessibility for people who are sight or voice impaired.
Pretty cool, huh? We ain't seen nothing yet. Let's go back to Julian's question about how there may be differences in the phonemic structure or the nuances on phonemes in different languages. And so even though this is a much easier problem because you know what you're trying to do. You just say, let me just assign to my pattern of phonemes some acoustic representation. You can have lots of fine tuning with different language dialects. And so let me go back to this cool demo here. Let's just find some table. We'll go to like the homepage of the iSchool. And we'll say, what is the iSchool about? Is something cool? Is that what it is?
The The score of information is both the Seaburg, whose newest and its smallest school, located in the central campus. The I School is a graduate education and research community that crosses the boundaries of law, economics, sociology, business, library, science, engineering, design, publishing, linguistics.
Did that pretty fast, didn't it? Watch this.
The School of Information is both UC Berkeley's newest and its smallest school. Located in the center of campus, the iSchool is a graduate education and research community that crosses the boundaries of law, economics, sociology, business, library science, engineering, design, publishing, linguistics.
One more. One more. You'll love this one.
School of Information is both UC Berkeley's newest and its smallest school, located in the center of campus. The iSchool is a graduate education and research community that crosses the boundaries of law, economics, sociology, business, library science, engineering, design, publishing, linguistics.
And this this particular demo even lets us do translation and synthesis at the same time.
Es choro información y foto, pero que le hice una vez a mí, es choro. Lo que hace dice es entero que estamos de choro y sagrado a ter, gracias a Andrés E. H. con un invitado, pero es secundario, es lo que la economía, sociología, como si es libra de ciencia, en fin, hay algo, decir, publicín, lingüis.
How did you do?
So just trying to read it like with a different accent, but it is actually translating.
It's not translating it?
It's using English words.
Okay, so it's using English the Spanish the sound pattern on the English words. So it wasn't translating it. Oh, too bad. So if I give it in Spanish, you can try it in Spanish. But I'm going to do it. Okay. Well, that's pretty cool, and I urge you to have fun with this, because you can actually record things and download them. Like, you can make, like, anti-machine stuff and everything, right? Okay? You can claim that you have an Indian roommate and make a little anti-machine, right? Yeah. Okay, well, you know, some people argue that things like BART consciously use not perfect speech because they want you to pay more attention to it. So you'll pay more attention to something which is clearly a computer voice than something which is just a person with an accent. But that's sort of a kind of a usability kind of question, I suppose. Is that cool or what? Yeah.
They need to train those things to match the pace of the person using the software, because it's like the responses are constantly so slow when I use the software. Like, do you think it would be possible to see how, like an IVR system, like how quickly the user is speaking to the system, and then have the system use the same rate?
Yeah, there's actually... Not exactly that, but I've seen demos of a karaoke machine which keeps up with you. So that if you're a good fast singer, it'll speed up. If you're slow, it'll slow down for you. So it's because it's sort of trying to monitor your pace of singing.
What I was thinking about is trying to understand like the demographic context of the people, of the person who's speaking, is that you could also use this context information in order to retrieve like more relevant stuff. Like if you know these people, that this person is from the south, or that this person is speaking with an Indian accent or with a British accent, the queries to your information retrieval systems could be more relevant.
So if you're doing spoken queries, you could use the accent to change relevance.
Yeah.
Interesting idea. Yeah.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm. So T-Mobile will try to tell you that they ask you if they would talk to talk faster to you.
Right. And but funny thing is they don't use this for the actual deadline. This was for the number that you need to switch to another line.
Okay. Yeah, the point I want to make is that this is not the reverse of speech recognition, just another cool technology, but it's often needed in the same context as speech recognition for the obvious reason. You recognize, then you play it back, let's say. Okay, let's move on to more of the text-based stuff. Text summarization is an important application in NLP. Often you want to take some document in a collection, or one or more documents, and summarize so you can convey what they're about with significantly fewer words. This requires extracting the important content, maybe abstracting it so that you can say it more concisely, fusing it together, and doing that in a way which maintains some coherence in the paragraph structure, the sort of discourse structure. And this, we identify important context using a number of different features and heuristics. I'm sure you can think of what they are. What kind of features would tell you when something's important in a paragraph? It could be bold. It could be in a different font. Different presentation rule would tell you what's important. That's one idea. It could be frequently occurring entities. That's right. So it's repeating some of the specific kind of things that you know are important. How about if it says things like, "This is important"? All right. I mean, you could obviously use signaling phrases like, "In conclusion, in summary, I want to emphasize that." So those kind of phrases would clearly be good signals. Now that, in fact, was the way it started, but that has tended to be less useful than more statistical things. We tend to use now the traditional TF-IDF kind of notions to identify important content. You can find things like, if we compute the statistics for the entire collection or the entire document, let's say which sentence is most like the entire collection, maybe that means it's the best summary of the collection. Which paragraph is most like the entire document, for example? Or which paragraphs are the ones which are telling the tightest story? And maybe just pick some of those out to show what the document is about. Some document types have a regular discourse or frame structure, so you have a kind of slot notion of saying, to summarize the story, I've got to identify five key things. Now, if you're a reporter, you say who, what, when, where, why, but that's pretty generic. You can think about that being in more specific domains, a little easier to find. So what are the slots in a sports story? I want to summarize a long article about some game. What do I want to find?
Score.
The scores. The teams. Okay. Would it do better for a generic sports story or a specific sports story, like the baseball summarizer or the football summarizer? Clearly, you see how the more I know about the specific kind of slot content, the more I can find them with things like dictionaries and stuff. What are the slots in an election story? Winner, loser, percentage, political party. How about earthquake story? What would the earthquake story have in it? Richter scale, location. You can sort of see that if you had this collection of story types, once you know it's one of those, you then can then quickly find the parts by looking for the most common phrases. But if I gave each of you an article that picked the 10 most important sentences, do you think you'd be very consistent at that? In general? Jess, what do you think?
I mean, if we picked the 10 sentences?
Yeah, ordinary people pick 10 sentences out of a story.
I mean,
now, ordinary, unwashed people who haven't been blessed with the knowledge of 202.
Yeah.
The world at large, almost never. It's actually harder, which is why it's because people have biases of what they think is important in the story. Surprise, surprise, surprise. So it's actually hard to evaluate these things because what counts as a good summary depends on your point of view. Let's talk about one last topic of information extraction. Suppose you want to change jobs and you want to be a baker. You've always wanted to cook things, so you want to be a baker. So you go to Google and say, baker job opening. And you find baker job and you find things about Baker University, and you find things about Baker Hughes, which is the oil field company. And you find a lot of things which have nothing to do with jobs for bakers. But if you go to monster.com and search for baker, you get baker jobs. How is that? All these just baker jobs. You find only baker jobs if you go to monster.com. Amazing, huh? What's happened? Last time, Thomas.
It's vertical search engine and full search is certain domain.
Well, how did it know? How did it know what's in monster.com?
Just jobs.
And how did it find them?
Well, partly through puzzles that people enter there.
But not entirely. It goes and finds things that are jobs and sucks them into monster.com. How does it find things that are jobs? There are slots for jobs. Jobs have a frame, right? They have a title, they have an employer, they have locations, right? So there's some sort of stereotypical structure of job postings, and Monster knows how to find them. And of course it does let you fill them in directly, but it'll find jobs that are not posted as jobs on Monster.com. It'll go find them and bring them to Monster.com. That's one of their real added values. So this idea of aggregating things of the same type by finding the particular patterns for information and then extracting kind of the slot fillers is kind of a very common kind of information extraction application. You can think of all sorts of things that are like that, like trying to you are a company that wants to gather the names and the phone numbers or addresses of businesses that you might be able to sell to. So you're saying, who is in the business of doing XYZ? Let me go find them so I can send them offers, send them my catalog. Or what are my potential competitors publishing and talking about on their websites? And I want to use that to suck the data out of their application and put them into my sales application. Market intelligence. I know everything's happening about some particular kind of product out there. So I'm going to basically be monitoring any mention of these products. And I want to grab the context around that and maybe have these little mini stories at each time when I pull them in. I want to know about pricing in my industry, things like that. And of course, we have business intelligence of the class where we're saying, let me look at all the transactions that I've done, other websites, web services, and pull them onto one big collection as if they were a single virtual database. Then I have central intelligence and homeland security where I want to keep track of potential bad guys and what potential bad guys are doing, or bad girls. I suppose there's some bad girls out there as well. And build a database, a collection of information about all what the bad actors are doing and so on. Can you do some information extraction and extract the keyword in all four of those categories of applications? It's intelligence, right? Because we are trying to act more intelligently, make better decisions by having better information, which we get by increasing the precision of our data collection. And only having stuff which is directly relevant to us and have it in a very precise way. So it's probably disingenuous to start with monster.com when, in fact, a great amount of this work started in the intelligence community. There was a huge amount of funding in the 80s and 90s in the U.S. By DARPA, of conferences were called the Message Understanding Conference, or the MUC conferences. And so if you look for MUC IE, you'll find the top one here, the conference results from these information extraction conferences run by the intelligence community to test new algorithms and approaches for mining data like this about bad guys and stuff. Of course, this is often just one step of a natural language processing application. You may do some coarse categorization about the kind of story it is first, which of course we haven't talked about yet. And then we use the IE stuff to sort of find the important semantic nuggets in different kinds of more topic-dependent approaches. We'll talk about task categorization next time. I want to point out that just as in every other part of natural language processing, we've had this evolution of techniques. We started off for the first decade or so using hand-built systems built by experts. We had large number of people working in government agencies writing rules for, given this kind of document, how is it going to be, what is the where can we find the most important pieces of information in it? Which we would find or somehow get our hands on large collections of Russian documents or German documents or whoever else we were snooping on at the time, and try to extract these semantic nuggets from it. This was a lot of work. When we got to the web, we extended it with a lot of handcrafted work. Typically the concept was one of screen scraping. You go there and say, gee, looks like these people are publishing this stuff in the following format. The fifth thing down the screen is this. Let's assume that's going to be the one we want. And write these very tweaky kind of sets of rules. That really doesn't scale. And about 1990s, there was a start to be a shift in the IE technology to move toward what were going to be systems which would learn the rules automatically, sort of find the rules and then use them. Of course, this required all the work of the previous decade to have done it by hand, so you have essentially a collection of things in which you've identified the things you want to extract rules from. So if you don't have the labeled collection to begin with, you can't have a system automatically learn from it. But more recently, we've started to use statistical models where we're using techniques which actually learn what the rules are just by seeing patterns in the data as opposed to having to have them labeled. So it figures out what the category should be and then uses that to find the boundaries between different types of entities. Again, this still benefits a lot by having examples, but the part now in statistical learning theory is learning to do things which are unsupervised, meaning that they don't need to have languages trained to begin with. In fact, the really cutting edge of this field is work which is trying to learn what is the right form of the model we're trying to learn, and then learn the actual type of rules for that model. So you say, is this best represented as a graph or a tree? And then try to figure out what the labels of the branches should be. That's really hard, cool stuff. Some of it's being done on this campus by people like Tom Griffiths over in cognitive science. Okay, let's look at this real simplistic example. If we have some body of text, like here's a press release from Microsoft or something about this, or some story about Microsoft, and we basically have some notion of what should be the parts of a story. We're looking for, just find the entities first, name, title, organization. We find these things which look like these proper names or nouns, like Bill Gates, Microsoft CEO, Stom, and so on. We then say, gee, these have, they go together, things like there may be the CEO is Bill Gates, the company that goes to Bill Gates is Microsoft. So you're building relationships among these entities. And if we can regularize the relationship, we can end up having a database where we can say we now know person, title, organization. And again, this idea of getting to a database representation where we have regularized knowledge from a unstructured text collection is really what IE is about. So you essentially use, you're trying to push things from one end of the document spectrum to the other end by doing work. Okay, and of course, wouldn't it be nice if we started with this? We had marked up text that said Bill Gates, you know, CEO, company, Microsoft, you know, with tags around those pieces of text. It wouldn't be necessary. So it's a question of where you do the work and where you get the benefit. Let's go back and look at the top 10 slides before we end. Again, the I want to point out that NLP really is motivated by this notion that it's not sufficient just to find documents. You want to go beyond the document to find out what they're about. And that might mean finding the important parts that are going to be useful to answer questions or to do things like language translation. This language translation is one of the sort of big test cases of this field because it brings in so many different parts of the NLP problem. And it has used a number of different approaches, but now it's settled mostly on statistics-intensive approaches because of the presence of things like the Google corpus that lets us use statistical co-occurrence to find aligned phrases in parallel documents. And again, that's such a large corpus that even obscure phrases may occur enough times to resolve ambiguities like the one here for group de travail. We talked about name-ending recognition as an important thing to find these nuggets. It's often a starting point of a translation or other NLP application. We can use it because of the structural regularity of the language, as you saw here. We had a little fun with speech recognition and synthesis, but the point there is that they're not the same thing, but they often go together in applications. Summarization, again, is a very common application that has to use things like TF-IDF to figure out what is the most diagnostic or discriminating part of a document to tell you what it's about. That should be a pretty straightforward analogy from what you did last week. And we talked about information extraction as this activity of trying to get back to a database representation in some sense of an unstructured story where you think, of course, it could have been that way at the beginning if you'd gone to the trouble of tagging the entities and the relationships in the original text. So we have one more lecture on NLP. I want to put that read in a slightly different order than they show up in the syllabus. The primary topic for Wednesday will be text categorization, where we're trying to distinguish different kinds of doc, what they're about. There are three papers. One is about sentiment, a real short one about sentiment detection, that is whether something is positive or negative about something. There's a paper called From Fingerprint to Right Print, trying to figure out how to identify the author of some document. And there's a really cute paper called The Plan for Spam, which is using Bayesian statistics to distinguish spam from not spam. I'll spend some time doing probability 101 to explain how some of that machinery works. And finally, the paper, which I'm not going to get to or get through, but has a couple of nice big ideas about how all these NLP applications come together in commercial applications to converge text intelligence and business intelligence in what's called the content mining platform. You'll see how this could be useful in businesses to manage all the interaction with customers. And I think that's it.